It's lovely to see your hellos and warm greetings in the chat stream. Feel free to say hi there if you would like to still. So I am Sean Oakes. I use he and they pronouns. I'm in Northern California on ancestral Pomo land, just a bit north of Spirit Rock Meditation Center, where I work and teach. And I live with my family out here in on the edge of redwood forest with red-tail hawks and red and gray foxes and a bunch of humans and animals and children and creatures of all sorts running around the land. And it's really a pleasure to be back with you on this spring day in the season known in the Buddhist world as Vesak or Wisaka Puja in Pali. This is the full moon of the month of Wisaka, which is May, usually, in the Western calendar. So this was this past Monday. And this is Buddhist year 2568. So that's 2568 years since the Buddha's death, as reckoned by the Thai calendar. There's some variations in the year reckoning, so you'll see it off by a year in other Southeast Asian countries, and there's a couple different ideas for when that happened. But this is the current Thai consensus, which is my primary lineage. And it's been sweet this year to reflect on the Buddha a few different times and some different teachings, pulling out some different aspects of this person. Vesak as a holiday is sometimes casually known as Buddha Day. There's three main holidays in the Buddhist year, one for each of the Triple Gem, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. This is the one for the Buddha, celebrating the birth, awakening, and death of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha. He called himself the Tathagata, the one thus gone. And he was a prince in a small republic, the Sakyan Republic, in what's now northern Bihar state in India. And you know various aspects of his story. So he is the root teacher of our current Buddha Sasana or dispensation or teaching ecosystem of the Buddha. He's not the only Buddha. Buddhas arise in the world periodically whenever the karma ripens for them to appear. They are Buddhas because they arise in a time when the Dhamma is not present in the world. So Buddhas arise, rediscover the ancient path, and then teach it. And so this happens again and again and again. The Pali texts frequently mention six Buddhas previous to ours, and other texts, increase that list up into the 20s and, back into mythic cosmic time. But Buddhas are human beings. They are not gods. They're not blessed with any, divine powers. They are suffering people who are inspired and who are ready to seek the way and find the complete uprooting of ancient trauma and suffering in their own hearts. And doing so, they become awakened ones or Buddhas. And they teach a path. So we are gathering in the lineage of our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, and on this holiday, in whatever way your life has been touched by the Buddha and that has brought you here, I'll just invite us to begin with, in our own hearts, just remembering what's come to you in this life through contact with the Dhamma and just hearing about the Buddha and the teachings. All right, I'm pausing. I mean, folks say the sound is low. Let me see what I can do about that. Oh, I know what I can do about that. The microphone fell off. All right. All right. Thank you for saying so. All right. Are we back with hearable sound? All right. Did you really miss the like inspirational beginning? Here's the short version. Whatever the Buddha has touched in your life, remember that with gratitude now, because we are in a moment that is not always the case, that the Dharma is present in the world, still being taught, still being realized and practiced. And here we are, 2,568 years after the passing of a great teacher whose brilliance was maintained by a dedicated community of practitioners, of friends, for all these thousands of years. So it's a pleasure to be here in Vesak, or just after Vesak, with you. So let's sit in meditation together. Sit always means probably sitting, but some of you might be laying down or standing. I understand sit in the traditional sense of the Pali and Sanskrit term asana, which means partly means the cloth or the platform that you're sitting on, and that it really points to stillness more than any particular posture. So I'll say, come into a posture that's conducive for easeful stillness, whatever that means for your body in this moment in your life. If you are in a sitting posture, whether that's cross-legged on a cushion or kneeling on a bench or sitting in a chair or sitting supported by any kind of furniture or postural arrangement, the goal can begin with the sense of feeling grounded to the earth, present here, rooted in this place. You can feel the lower body from the hips down really sinking, settling. If possible, supporting the hips to tip slightly forward, so you're really right on the two sit bones at the base of the pelvis. If the bowl of the hips can tip slightly forward, that brings the low back into its natural curve and can give a sense of ease and openness through the belly, so the breath can move in the belly. Sense of openness through the solar plexus in the front of the chest, so the breath can move fully through the whole front line of the body. And if you can do so without strain, you might lift the sternum a little, letting the shoulders fall open. Let the chin relax, soften through the whole face, and let the base of the skull and the back of the head open toward the wall behind you. And we're feeling for an easeful balance, head, heart, and belly, like beads on a plumb line, balanced right over our center of gravity. My first Buddhist teacher, a Japanese Zen teacher, said that the Buddha is a name or a term for the center of gravity. This fulcrum point at the heart of our being, around which all of our uprightness orients. We are beings of matter, of form. And so we exist in constant relationship with our great form, companion, friend, mother, ecosystem, parent, self, lover, this earth. All matter is drawn toward other matter. And our tiny matter moving about the surface of the earth, eating the food of the earth, giving our waste back to the earth. We move around on the earth, ever drawn toward its center. When we find the upright seat, we find it in relation to the center of the earth. And we grow the spine straight up out of the earth, just as the straight-trunked trees do. And of course, some of us are bent-trunked trees, which is beautiful in its own way and still always responding to gravity. We respond to the upward impulse and we respond to the downward impulse, rooting, landing, spreading. One of the mythic terms for the tree under which the Buddha sat is the navel of the world, the rooting or birthplace of the world. It said that when the Buddha found this tree, this great spreading, capacious tree, this fig tree to sit under, he thought, this will do for practice. This will do for striving. This was when he was finally ready after many years of arduous practice. He's finally ready with the intuition for how to awaken. And he gathered up some grass, kusa grass. The mythic story says that the spirit of the kusa grass sang out to him, "Choose me, choose me." And he gathered up the grass for a seat and sat with the vow to not move from this spot until he was fully awake to the world. And of course, you don't make that vow until you know you're really ready. And he knew. And so when we take this seat, in this beautiful upright posture, however that manifests for our body, right? We make in our own bodies an image of this archetypal gesture of arriving at the center of the world, at the root of a great tree, near a clean flowing river, with the knowledge that we can do right here what needs to be done. Feel the posture, feel the breath moving through the posture. The first meditation the Buddha did upon sitting down on this cosmic or very earthly seat, both at the same time, really. The meditation that he did was not a deep, formless contemplation on nothingness. It wasn't a mantra. It wasn't confronting pain in the way that he had done so many times. It was a meditation in which he relaxed deeply, remembered a state of having been fully at peace as a child, resting under a rose apple tree during a spring festival, just at this time of year, May, the full moon. With the full moon overhead rising in the sky, he settles into breathing and contact with the body. As you breathe, can you feel the breath as a soft wave lapping at the shore of the body that is like the earth, the land of the earth, washed by this wave of the breath coming in and out. Feel the whole body in its posture, this noble posture of the Buddha's. Connect with the breath, washing the whole body. And feeling the pleasurable movement of breath energy through the whole body. Inviting the attention to land fully in the body, not distracted by story or external stimulation. Feel the whole body pulsing with breath. And feeling, if you can, the pleasure of not having to track anything outward, the pleasure of inwardness. The traditional instructions call this the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. This is the practice the Buddha does on his one fine night under the May full moon. Remembering his childhood, he drops into the body, letting go of the entire story of seeking, worrying, studying, fighting with the emotions. This is the practice that leads to what's called the first absorption or first jhana. Stabilize attention with the breath in the body. And stay just there, relaxing, letting go into that, until you can feel a kind of pleasure. We encourage that pleasure to grow. Mostly keep attention with the breath and the whole body. But as the sense of feeling good shows itself, there's a welcoming of that. This pleasure is both emotional in a way, the delight in letting go of all the worries and distractions and obsessions. And it's physical, the kind of vibration or hum you can feel in the body as you get quiet and turn inward. So we'll continue in this way for a bit in silence. Whatever the mind wanders to, soon as you notice, just remember this body and breathing. And feel again the whole body still pulsing with breath. And when the mind comes back from distraction, notice the difference in feeling. Really notice how pleasurable it is to be quiet and still. So that we're training ourselves to delight in stillness, to delight in this peaceful resting on the earth, at the root of our own tree, at the heart of the world, doing as our teacher did. So long ago, and not so long ago. As we come toward the end of the meditation, you might refresh the posture, full breath. And if the mind has been loose in the fields of story, thought, and distraction, just come back once more to the core intention to be right here. To learn the pleasure of presence, of stillness. I'll close the sitting and open into our study together with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So if you know this line and you're in a space where you can make sound, you might chant it with me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. All right. Now letting it go. And again, welcome. Welcome to anyone who came in while we were in stillness. It's good to be with you. Welcome to folks from all over the place. Some folks near to me here, Oakland, Santa Cruz, mountains. Welcome to folks from Stockholm and Galicia and London and Innsbruck and Wales in the UK and Montreal in Canada and all over the West Coast. And it's just lovely to see your names and your places and your faces here. So blessings to each one here. I'll talk a little bit about the Buddha and about Vesak, and we'll open into some discussion. I invite you to just be at ease in your space, happy to be together on this celebration of the holiday of our great ancestral teacher. So this young person named Siddhartha, family name Gautama of the Sakyan clan, is said to have been struck in his youth and young adult period in his 20s by an overwhelming sense of despair and fear as he encountered the world, as we do, as we come out of the bubble of childhood into adulthood. And he encounters the realities of the human world, really the world of all living beings, the reality of aging, sickness, and death. But also, those are the heavenly messengers mentioned in the myths, the story that the young Buddha has been hyper-protected by his father, Suddhodana, because his father has had the correct, as we now know, intuition that if his child was exposed to the reality of the world and its suffering, that he would leave the family and go into spiritual practice, seeking the deathless. This is, of course, what what Siddhartha is going to do. And his father is like, what if I, you know, what if I basically like lock him in a tower, you know, so that he won't experience the world as it is. And this is, you know, in the fairy tale of it, you know, the father is kind of like deluded, but in the deep psychology of it, the father is, you know, in a certain way doing something that, you know, in a certain way, as a father now myself, my kid is 9, we're totally having these conversations that are like, you know, how can we protect him from like media and social media and, you know, the terrible depredations of, you know, modern, you know, the media ecosystem devoted to harm, our contemporary culture devoted to harm, American culture with the violence that's baked into our culture. How do we protect him from that long enough for him to develop a healthy nervous system, and then bring him into contact with the horrors of the world, you know, the racist and genocidal history of this country, the patterns of, you know, misogyny and racism and oppression and greed that mark the world. How do we bring him into awareness of those in a way that doesn't give rise to despair, but gives rise to a very real, grounded, you know, ability to be healthy in the world and to do good work in the world? And this is a constant question, you know, for my partner and I, and for those of us, you know, raising kids in this culture. And there's a way that I have a lot of, you know, I have more sympathy for Suddhodana now than I ever did in this story, you know, that he's not just the like hyper-protective old king, you know, my son will never go past the walls of the palace and therefore we'll keep him here forever. But that there's a kind of, you know, that there's a kind of compassion to it. Deluded as it may be to think that we can protect our children from, you know, reality for very long, but we try a little bit. And so, you know, the story being what it is, he wouldn't be the Buddha if he doesn't actually encounter the suffering of the world. And so he jumps the wall and goes into town and sees old age, sickness, and death. But of course, seeing old age, sickness, and death right out there on the street, you know, corpses carried away through the street, people dying of illness in the gutters, which is essentially what he sees, you know, folks not having the best health care, we might say. He sees folks in poverty. He sees the reality of the city, you know, full of people suffering. And he's struck profoundly by this and you know, is driven to try to find an answer to this completely natural question of like, what the hell is going on in this human world, in this birth? And so, you know, so he does his practice and finds the way and, you know, eventually recalls this childhood moment, resting at deep ease, concentrating the mind, and then he uses that concentrated mind, really very highly focused attention, to investigate, to remember. He uses it to remember his past, to remember into the ancestral past. And in the text, this is described as remembering his past lives. The past lives are described not so much, and they are described as personal, but not in a like, oh, I was this particular person and that's what it means for this life that I'm in now, or I was that particular kind of person and that's what it means for this life now. It wasn't a psychological or psychodynamic or personal narrative kind of past life journey that he had. It is very much a journey into the universality of birth and death. He remembers, you know, multiple cosmic eons of births and deaths. And in such a way that it washes out all the specificity of a given life. And it's really like he tunes into, you know, oh, this is just how it is, and this is how it's always been, and there's no conceivable beginning to the universe. There's no creator God who sits outside the system, created everything, watches over it, you know. There's just this perpetual ecosystem of beings being born and seeking pleasure, experiencing pain, and dying over and over and over forever. And there's no beginning can be found to this. And he does this not through speculating on it or coming into faith with a deity or being told it by a deity, but by seeing it directly. He remembers it. He uses the faculty of memory to do this. And so when he begins to teach the path to the freedom that arose as a result of his doing this, he emphasizes this way of being in the world and way of investigating the world that was both part of a movement of spiritual practice common in his day, called the Shravaka movement. The people who had, like him, left their homes, their extended families, and were seeking knowledge, mostly through meditation or other intense practices. He did a lot of those practices. There was a whole movement of people doing this that he joined. And there were many competing schools of teachers who had done this kind of practice and had come to some realization and were teaching their method. And then there was a hereditary class of Brahmin priests who were still doing practices that had been developed over the last 1,500 years or so, that we now call the Vedic or Brahmanic practices of ritual sacrifice to ecosystem deities for the smooth functioning of the ecosystem. And the Buddha did something really radical after he had his own realization, which is that he taught a path that relied completely on personal or individual experience of truth. This is, I think, one of the things that feels natural to a lot of us postmoderns, but was quite radical in his time and was radical for most of the couple thousand years since his time, which is that he did not teach a tradition that needed a metaphysical superstructure to be believed in. He didn't say you have to come into faith in a deity who will then save you. Those ideas would become very popular in the world, as you know, shortly after his life. But he also didn't teach a system like the Brahmanic or Vedic system that was around him, that there were these godly forces and that there were certain rituals that you could do that would bring you to be reborn in their heaven realms. Brahmins would come to him and get into arguments. And one of the classic arguments was that at one point this kind of very skilled Brahmin student who's good at argument and debate comes to him and essentially says, you know, the Brahmins teach a path to the divine. And they are the only ones who could teach that, partly because Brahmins are special and they're the highest caste. And the Buddha, just bit by bit, in a very kind of Socratic way, like asking questions back to the Brahmin student, first systematically dismantles or deconstructs, we would now say, the claim that the Brahmins are the highest caste. And he talks about issues that will be familiar in modern racial politics. He talks about, you know, what happens if, you know, a Brahmin marries a non-Brahmin of different castes, and of what caste is the child then? And goes through, you know, well, what if there's a Brahmin that studies the text and one that doesn't, or one that is ethical and then one that doesn't? And by bit by bit chipping away at the poor logic of the Brahmin student, and of course this is a Buddhist text, so the Buddha always wins the argument in the Buddhist texts, but this was a long running debate in the time, what makes one worthy? And the Buddha starts to redefine the term Brahmin as, you know, one that is worthy or noble, rather than one that is of the right birth or skin color. The Brahmins were proud of being paler in skin color than the so-called lower castes, including the indigenous folks in India. The Buddha's people and the Vedic people, the Brahmanic people, all probably were descendants of immigrants from Central Asia who had come from the Caucasus and Persia and the steppes of Central Asia with horses around the Himalayas through the Indus Valley in what's now Pakistan into the Valley of the Ganga, maybe a couple thousand years before the time of the Buddha, maybe as recent as 1500 or so years before the time of the Buddha. And they called themselves the noble people, the Aryan people. And so even in the Buddha's time, there's a system of classes or castes where the priestly caste put itself at the top and then the aristocrats below, down through merchants and workers. But then there's a whole group of folks who are not part of the caste system. And those would be folks who weren't part of the Aryan culture at all. And so this includes the indigenous folks who had been in South Asia forever. Nowadays, they're sometimes called the Adivasi people. And you know, if you're American and horrified and exhausted by the American genocide and the long fight for justice by the North American indigenous peoples in Canada and the U.S. and Mexico in different ways, throughout the Americas in different ways, it might not be reassuring, but it might at least be contextualizing to understand that this is a process that has happened all over the world in many, many, many different ways. The process is here in the Americas and, you know, like down in Australia with the Aboriginal folks there are just the most visible, you know, aspect of this now. Processes happening in Brazil with the indigenous tribes in the Amazon. But that this is an ancient process, and that the indigenous folks or modern folks who trace themselves to the indigenous South Asians and don't identify with the new culture of the Vedic peoples are still having protests for land and rights in India to this day. We were around one protest like this in India when we were there, and we said, you know, what's the politics? What's the underlying issue? And they were talking about an issue of land rights and legal rights for these people. And I said, oh, you know, they're indigenous folks, like, what are they, you know, tracing their ancestry to? And they say, oh, they're tracing their ancestry to before the Vedic people came, before the Aryan people came. And I'm like, they've been fighting for rights for 3,500 years and are still here, right? Like, so this is not just ancient history, but this is a living conversation between peoples in this place. And so the Buddha, back to the Buddha, does this extraordinary thing. He does not call on a metaphysics that that proposes that anything is true in a way that you can't verify yourself. So he takes apart this Brahmin argument that Brahmins are the highest caste, and this becomes part of the Buddha's most radical social action, which is the creation of an alternative community, completely kind of under the bubble of the larger Vedic culture, but also separate from it legally. And he creates this sangha, this community of practitioners, that becomes extremely stable and well organized. And it's one of the reasons why Buddhism survives, is that his monastic community was the most organized of almost all of them of the time. very clear set of rules and guidelines and legal structures. And the main thing that happens when you join the Buddhist Sangha is that you lose your caste. So whatever you were, your caste falls away as a legal distinction. And, you know, if someone from a very poor or peasant caste was ordained into the Sangha 5 minutes before a prince or a very high-ranking Brahmin or aristocrat, that peasant or ex-peasant would be senior to the royal person who was ordained, and it's a purely seniority-oriented system. So your elders in the system are anyone who was ordained before you, and you always bow to them as your senior, no matter what social position you were in before you joined. And so throughout the Buddha's teaching, he both emphasizes, you know, what are the qualities that we can see here and now that define people? And so he ends up in this conversation with this young Brahmin redefining what makes a person a Brahmin, not by birth or training even, but by ethical action. Right? And he really gets the student to come down to admitting that the thing that really makes a person worthy of respect is their actions. You know, are they causing harm? Are they not causing harm? And so this approach washes down through every aspect of the teaching. And there's this beautiful long Pali word, compound word, that is fun to say, and you should learn to say it. And it means knowing and seeing things as they are. So knowing and seeing things clearly, directly. And the phrase is yata bhuta jnana dasana. It starts with yata bhuta, which is things as they are, or things in their suchness or their thusness. Yata is like the thus or such preposition. Yata bhuta, things as they are, jnana dasana, which is knowledge and vision. So seeing and knowing things as they are. This is the basis of the meditative training. This is the basis of the training that leads to wise view and that leads to freedom from the defilements, from the freedom from the ancient traumas that keep us reborn into a world that's so painful over and over and over and over. And so this seeing things as they are becomes the heart of what the Buddha teaches. One of the ways I think the Buddha is radical and so resonant for us nowadays is that it's because of this focus on seeing directly that the teachings are in a certain way so friendly to a more or less atheistic modern audience, because they don't ask us to, you know, believe in something we haven't experienced for ourselves. Even when the Buddha says, you know, these are the practices that lead to being reborn in heaven, or that these are the practices that lead to being able to see your past lives, those things sound supernatural only if you don't know how to do them. But they are meditative states. They are things that you can train the attention to do. And the Buddha is very pragmatic about even this. So, you know, when he says, you know, like practicing the Brahmaviharas, the practice of training the heart to radiate love in all directions without exception. When he says this leads to, you know, rebirth in the realms of the divine, he says so, first of all, because he says he's seen it directly. But he also says, you don't need to believe it. This is the heart of the famous Kalama Sutta, where these people come to him and they say, we don't know what to believe. There's all these teachers. They say all sorts of things. And the Buddha says, great, don't believe them. Don't believe me. Don't believe any of that stuff on hearsay. Or even because someone you think has authority says it. Believe it when you see it for yourself. And so he says, so here's the practice, you know, radiate love in all directions, radiate the, you know, radiate the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings in all directions. And what you'll experience is you will experience states where the sense of the individual self drops away, the sense of the individual story and the neuroses of like, who am I? What am I doing in the world? All that drops away. And the dramas of individual relationship, romantic relationships, social relationships, work relationships, political relationships, that drops away because the meditative state of infinite love is so powerful that it blows away our sense of being an individual. And we can feel this force of benevolence pervading the universe. Lots of meditation traditions and religions have found ways to connect with this, like the state of infinite love. But the Buddha does something very particular with it. A lot of traditions, including other traditions of his time, make the metaphysical leap into saying, because we can perceive the entire universe as pervaded by love, therefore the nature of the universe is infinite love, right? This is the nature of God, or this is the nature of truth, is infinite love. But notice what they're doing, right? They're taking an experience that we can have, and they're interpreting that in a religious framework. They're saying, because I've had this experience, this must be how things are, you know, external to myself. This is a description of reality. God is infinite love. In a certain way, that's just language. That's just a way to describe it. And I'm cool with that. I think God is infinite love. But what this can do is it can suggest to us that something that I can't necessarily verify has to be believed in, right? It can turn into a relationship to an external divine or a faraway reality or a kind of philosophical reality. But then here I am, you know, struggling as always. And the Buddha says, don't believe that like the universe is infinite love, because someone says it. The thing that's important is to experience something for yourself. And the result of experiencing it for yourself is not that you've somehow verified a metaphysical truth, like, aha, now I know for myself that the universe is infinite love. The result actually is a very pragmatic result, that my life changes when I see things for myself. I realize that I am able to let go of some of the constrictions of my own heart that come from being immersed in my narrative, immersed in the like, I love them, they don't love me, I want this, I don't get it, I got something I didn't want, it, like being sick or whatever, like, you know, I'm afraid of people in the world. I'm scared of the political situation. I'm struggling in the very personal manifestations of oppression. You know, the way that as a mixed race queer person, I can feel that. I can feel a hostility toward those identities in the United States right now. Right, like I can be in the personal. Right. And there's truth in all of that. Those identities are oppressed right now in the United States. And there's a reality to that. And I'm not trying to, you know, wash away or somehow deny the reality of that by saying I can also connect with love as an infinite force. But the Buddha says, but when we do this, when we learn to feel the world as infinite love, feel infinite metta, the result that we're going for is a relaxing of grasping or clenching in the heart, Right? We're going for the relief of suffering. And so the Buddha will say again and again that if you're stuck in existential questions, like, do I exist really or do I not exist? Is God real? Is God not real? What is awakening anyway? Is it real? Is it not real? That those are useless questions. They don't lead anywhere. That the thing that is useful is through meditation and inquiry and just the maturing of the heart on the path that we come to see things directly. And again, this is a subtle distinction. We see things directly, not that we're getting a confirmation of a metaphysical reality. Ah, the universe is infinite love. It's that we see directly through our own lens. This is, nowadays we would call this phenomenological. We engage with the phenomena itself. I entered into a meditation on loving kindness. I experienced the individual self being washed away by a feeling of benevolence that feels like it filled the whole universe. I can describe this completely without metaphysical language. Right? The practitioner enters a meditative state that feels like this. And it has this result, you know. Oh, I remembered a past life. I remembered several past lives. And in doing so, my attachment to this life weakened. My attachment to health and long life and success and, you know, romance and all the things I want weakened as I saw that this craving for comfort and safety and security and pleasure is just a natural, organic force that moves through bodies everywhere in more or less the same kind of way. And so seeing things and knowing them as they are really is like a seeing and knowing direct experience as it is. And so the Buddha then teaches this throughout the subjects that he teaches on. They all come back to this, you know. And we can use this in our own meditation, you know. When I get lost in a particular distraction, and I could go into like, you know, why am I feeling this way, and what are the forces in my life that are making me feel this way? I can get into some analysis of my story, and the instructions, you know, will come back again and again to saying, this is a story, right? Oh, I can feel how this is a story, and what's here? This story is charged through with fear or anxiety, right? I'm worried about what will happen in the future or with my job or with my family or with my country. And we always want to understand all the layers of this, right? Like my fear for my family is appropriate given that like I live in an extremely expensive place. Okay, so I'm afraid, you know, for our well-being, like that's natural and not ungrounded given the economic reality of this place. Or I'm afraid for my country, or I'm just afraid of aging, you know, and my fingers are starting to feel creaky on the keyboard and a teeny bit of maybe arthritis is starting to come. And sometimes I feel that little twinge in a knuckle and I'm like, oh, I don't want that future where my hands hurt all the time, you know. Honest thing to not want, right? No problem. Knowing and seeing things as they are is the practice that cuts through every layer of our suffering, right? It's the practice that allows me to say, yeah, well, this is the nature of the body. Bodies get old. You know, here's my fingers get feeling creaky, right? That's the sensation is real. My age is real. You know, whatever I choose to do about it, take some supplements or whatever, get going on my joint care, do that. That's real too, you know. My despair being immersed in the American healthcare ecosystem, that's real, right? Be real with that. Yatta Bhuta Jnana Dasana is a way of saying, don't rely on a metaphysical projection to get out of the reality of anything that's right in front of you. This emotion of fear, it's real. This emotion of gratitude, it's real. The political reality, it's real. You know, the nature of pain in the joints, it's real. Like every layer of it is just what it is. And we spend so much time, in a sense, trying to internally maneuver our way out of feeling things as they are, you know, and figuring out what to do about them. And so the Buddha then is radical in not putting forward any religious or metaphysical proposal that's going to help you relieve your suffering. He says, no, you have to practice. You encounter it directly for what it is. When you encounter something that's unacceptable, like a Brahmin caste that thinks that they're better than everyone because they're a little bit paler and they have, you know, a lot of generational wealth, you can just knock that right down in argument, and you can create an alternative culture that actually, you know, creates social resistance against that all the way through into the 20th century, where the great low-caste politician Ambedkar publicly converted to Buddhism along with, you know, tens of thousands, some stories say hundreds of thousands, of his followers, which immediately removed them from the Hindu legal system and the oppression of being low-caste. So this has been a political gesture as well as a spiritual or sacred gesture for a long time, right? And it persists as that. So the Buddha's radical approach manifests both in the social political realm in all of these ways. See things directly for what they are, you know? Kings are not divine. Brahmins are not divine, right? Cut through the mythos that motivates, power politics. And then on the spiritual level, exactly the same way, cut through the mythos of the personal psyche or the religious devotion, cut right to the heart of why this life is so difficult. And you can do this by using the power of the heart, the power of the attention, the power of focused mindfulness and investigation. And the wild promise at the heart of all of it that he has an intuition toward, doesn't even know if he'll find, because nobody around him has found it for a very long time. He sits down under that tree on the kusa grass and he says, I'm going to find it. And I know the way, but he doesn't know what he's going to find. And what he finds is that birth and death have been going on forever, and that our actions are why we experience the world as we do, and that it's possible to choose to no longer participate in the round of suffering, to no longer grasp at anything, and that having done so, one cannot be said to either exist or not exist, because you're beyond those questions, and that the happiness that comes from doing so is sublime and almost indescribable. He does this, and it's such a cataclysmic experience that we are sitting here 2,568 years after he teaches this for the rest of his life, and then dies between a pair of flowering trees in a beloved forest. And so many thousands of people have awoken to a profound happiness as a result of these teachings, that they've been inspired to preserve it. And so here we are, continuing that preservation out of gratitude and the delight in that this path exists in the world, that it's actually possible to see clearly for yourself and live in a wildly different way in the world. So pausing there. Thank you for your warm attention. We have a bit of time for questions about practice, responses. Joanne, hi, good to see you.
Hi, Sean. Lovely to see and hear you. Always thought-provoking. I was wondering if you're further down the path, are you able to innately experience things without some kind of external stimulation? I wonder how to articulate this. I've been meditating for a really long, long, long time, and I only experience this kind of natural buzz maybe a couple of times. But I feel like my threshold is better now that when I experience things, I'm less reactive. Yep. But I don't know how you do it innately without some kind of stimulation, if you understand what I say.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by innately. We're always in the sensate world, unless we're in a very, very deep formless meditation. But yeah, even those, you get into them through focusing. So we're always practicing in relation to the body and the senses. I think the thing that we can look for is not that we're withdrawing the attention away from sensory contact or somehow experiencing something separate from what we're sensing, but that as we sense, which includes thinking and feeling, we are available for, like, we're available for understanding. You can hold the kind of question, it's sort of an inquiry question of, like, what else is here as you're experiencing things? So, you know, maybe I sense the body and I feel a twinge in the body. It's a little bit painful and it reminds me of the aging body. And if I can experience that directly, like, oh, this is uncomfortable. And then I can also ask a question like, what else is here? And then I might notice, oh, there's a story about aging. Okay, that's here. You know, how's that? Oh, that's painful. Or there's some fear, or there's some curiosity about aging. You know, it's not always negative. Okay, so the what else is here? Oh, there's fear. Okay, fear feels like this. Curiosity feels like this. What else is here? And so what I'm always asking myself really is, can I understand this moment deeply? And particularly when I notice that suffering has arisen. So if I feel the twinge in the knuckles and my mind goes arthritis, and then I think, oh no, I'm getting older. Like, that's fine to just recognize that, you know, since sensations changing is part of aging, the thing I want to look for is, am I suffering? Is there craving? Am I like, is there a kind of, oh no, or like, I don't want this, or, you know, am I less happy now that I've noticed my knuckles than I was before I noticed it? And if I notice that, then that is to be understood. So then I turn attention to that. Like, oh yeah, right. Just even that little flicker of not wanting to age into a more painful body. You're like, oh, right. That's craving, right? Not wanting an experience is craving. So then I just want to say, what else is here? Oh, there's craving. There's craving, you know. There's wanting, or there's fear, whatever it is, and that's all. That's all it is. I'm just being with experience, but I'm trying to be with it in a detailed way, so that I'm not skimming over anything. Right. That way, I really understand it, and that the result of that is, you know, being able to experience the aging body without craving for it to be otherwise. When the Buddha was almost 80, he said, you know. He said, Ananda, his friend and attendant, he said, Ananda, I'm so old. I'm in so much pain. This body is like an old cart held together by straps. You know, the only time I experience relief from pain is if I drop into a very deep, formless meditation. Otherwise, it hurts all the time. But he's not suffering, right? He's just like, this is just how the body feels. I'm old. We've been walking around for 45 years, you know, tired. So.
So I'm reminded how you tell your stories, how you live your life. Are you saying then you experience whatever without dwelling on it, or do you have to kind of mellow in it and marinate?
Me personally, you know, sometimes I have equanimity and sometimes I don't. But I know where practice is leading. You know, I have enough of a felt sense to know what it feels like to not be confused about sensation or about a thought. You know, that's the direct experience that I'm pointing toward. Someone wrote in the chat, ehi pasi ko, that's the Pali term for seeing something for yourself. So that's what this is pointing toward. And, you know, I have enough sense of that that I'm confident to sit here and tell you to do it.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
See.
Other questions or thoughts here? Yeah, Samantha.
So thank you for the talk. That was really interesting, and I'm really grateful. And I'm new to Buddhism too, so that's why maybe I'm asking questions that are obvious, but I just want to really understand and see if I got it clearly. But yeah, I feel like sometimes I get confused because I think that two things can exist at the same times, at the same time, but they're opposite at the same time too. So I feel like I'm kind of struggling with the idea of seeing something for yourself and see things as they are, but then sometimes I feel like nothing really matters at the same time too. And I feel like if I talk about me personally, I'm the type of person that'll be questioning everything, and then I'll tell myself, well, is that really the reality of things, and does it really matter? And then I don't know, sometimes it can be overwhelming and then you just get sad. But I'm just trying to understand, is the purpose of Buddhism, how can I put it? I'm trying to find the best way to put it. But would you say that basically the purpose of this is to be able to not avoid suffering, but understand the suffering and then try to feel at peace with that, but see it as a practice? I don't know how to put it. It's just that sometimes I know that I tend to question my reality to the point of overthinking, and I think that I'm doing the good thing by thinking, but it's not quite it. So I'm trying to see, would you say that it's just a question of balance, understanding when it's good to think, and then sometimes understanding that it's not really the best thing to do to overthink? I don't know. I'm just rambling, so I hope that you try to
That's great.
understand. Yeah.
I think you're struggling in a great direction because that last piece, you know, sometimes it's totally necessary to think through and analyze something to try to understand, like, what's going on here? You know, what part of my story is playing out? Seeing things as they are, the thing that's hardest in sometimes about this is that this includes our own thoughts and feelings. So when you're looking at some aspect of your life or the world and you're analyzing it, partly, you know, the content of that thinking, right? I'm looking at, you know, some political structure and I'm like, yeah, this political structure is oppressive in whatever way. I can see that clearly. So that is partly seeing things as they are, but going deeper, seeing things as they are also means seeing that I'm thinking about it right now. So, okay, there's thinking. That's also true. And then I'm having a feeling about it. You know, I'm confused. Okay, confusion is true. So that's also what's true. So you don't leave anything out. It's not like I'm going to analyze it separate from myself. Part of the Buddha's brilliance was your analysis of the world always includes yourself. So, oh, I'm troubled by this. You know, okay, so there's troubledness happening. And then you mentioned a couple of times, you know, this question that's very, very common and important, really, like about what matters. Does it really matter? That's an ethical question. right? Like, what's important for us to give our attention to? You know, it is important for us to give our attention to, like, you know, unjust political systems, because we live in democracies, hopefully, sort of. We're trying to live in a democracy over here.
Yeah,
we'll be. Unless we can. And, you know, but it's on us to not, you know, give up, essentially, as members of ostensibly democratic cultures. And so it's important to understand, you know, things like that. It does matter. But mattering, the thought, what matters, that's also, right, that's thinking, that's maybe doubt or analysis. That's also understanding things as they are. But the question really, one of the questions I hear in your exploration is, that's always behind what matters, is what should I give my attention to? What's the appropriate, you know, place for me to give my energy, to put my energy? You know, should I go on a year-long meditation retreat and be like, whatever, y'all, see you in a year. I hope democracy doesn't die while I'm gone, you know? Or should I dive into social activism, or should I focus entirely on, like, finding my one true love, or should I go back to grad school and get another PhD? Like, I don't know. Whatever mm-hmm. You're always going to be trying to figure out what's the best use of my energy and my attention. And that's, you have to do that. We all have to do that and figure out, like, where are your passions and what's guiding you. And so what you're pointing to, and I think this is true for so many of us, part of what can feel paradoxical, I think, is that as we're drawn into spiritual practice, we can have a strong feeling toward multiple things that all matter and are important all at the same time. You know, engaging in my community matters, you know, seeing my cravings and, you know, inherited traumas as important and coming to inner healing totally matters, you know, and everything in between that matters, constructing a healthy life in the world, you know, with music and love and culture and beauty matters, right? So the encouragement here, in a way to keep it simple on the Buddhist side, is that the Buddha teaches a path that helps us not be in denial, helps us not kind of hide away in concepts about things, but tells us that again and again, we have to just get real with what's happening, including in our own thoughts and feelings. Like, you know, my concern for my culture is both appropriate because I care and there's compassion, and it also has craving and fear and suffering in it. And mm-hmm. so my job can be like, can I be real about all of that in a way that allows me to uproot some of that suffering, which really I think just means to grow up in relation to it, to understand that, yeah, empires rise and fall.
Mm-hmm.
There's evil in the world. People do bad things. You know, to come out of a utopian fantasy, to come out of any childish fantasy that the world should be nice. And at the same time, to not fall into bitterness or despair or, you know, nihilism, which is a totally understandable response to the world. And that's just falling into the story that the world sucks and is not worthy of my attention. And that's also just going to be see that for what it is. Like, oh, yeah, that's the despair voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you make an ethical choice. We all make an ethical choice right in the middle of that to be like, I'm going to try to do what's right. And that's going to mean tending the heart, tending the community, tending the larger culture, not falling into despair, not giving up, but also not being super bound and like clenched around things as they are. And that's mm-hmm. that's some of that. It's part of that weave.
That makes sense. That's interesting. I feel like at the end of the day, we're all trying to be happy and try to move forward. And sometimes the path's just really difficult because you have this suffering, you have the questioning, you avoid. But then you still have to question yourself, or else you'll just, I don't know, it makes me think of the story you were saying about Buddha's father. He was trying to preserve his son in some type of a golden cage. So it might look like happiness, but it wasn't really happiness. So to really understand the meaning of happiness, you have to experience and then go through the ups and downs. So you really value your life and try to have an impact, if that makes sense. So,
Absolutely.
okay.
Absolutely. All of that. All of that.
Cool. Okay.
Lovely to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Awesome. All right, and we'll close there. I'm around and available, so I have a Tuesday evening meditation group and a monthly Friday study group studying the texts. You're welcome to go to my website, find the various things that I'm doing, come and join. It's always a pleasure to be here with Sangha Live. I do encourage you in your delight and enthusiasm for the Dhamma to support Sangha Live with your dana, and I'm grateful for the dana you've extended toward me. So gratitude all round, and blessings of Vesak. May the Dhamma be a light in your life and shine out from you to through your actions to all those you meet. Thank you so much. And I'll see you when I see you, I hope, sometime to cross your path again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you,
Thank
George,
you.
and everybody at Sangha Live.